With the colonization of the Americas, a new class of people were created. The settlers from England had historically been disenfranchised. These individuals came to what would become the United States in order to own land, a privilege which had been reserved mainly for the gentry. However, this opportunity also came with another problem, lack of labor. Labor has been a consistent issue since the inception of the United States. It was resolved first via indentured servitude, then slavery, and a number of other nefarious strategies used by those in power. Almost from the beginning of the colonization, the target of these labor strategies have been African American people. Disenfranchisement of African Americans did not end after the Civil War. It continues to this day via the disproportionate incarceration of African Americans and their entry into legal slavery. This legal slavery occurs within the prison system, a practice which is supported and legitimized by the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution. The very amendment meant to guarantee the freedom of every person within the United States. In the United States, controlling intoxicating substances has historically been used as a way of controlling the populace. This strategy was more specifically used by those in power to control portions of the population which they deemed undesirable. During the 19th century, there were many Chinese immigrants coming to the United States. White citizens of San Francisco became uncomfortable with these immigrants. In order to criminalize the behavior of some of these immigrants, opium was made illegal in 1875. El Paso followed suit, making marijuana illegal in the face of a flood of Mexican immigrants in 1914. The fear of Mexican immigration started permeating the United States at this time. As more and more Mexican citizens fled the Mexican Revolution, these immigrants were linked with marijuana usage. This, and the exaggerated stories of the effects of marijuana, caused the public to fear a drug which it regularly consumed under the name cannabis. This resulted in the passage of the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937. In 1965, Jim Crow laws were deemed unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States. A mere 5 years later, the Controlled Substances Act was passed. A schedule list was created to categorize controlled substances, taking into account both the potential for abuse of the substance and its medical benefits. Schedule 1, the most restrictive category, was where marijuana was placed, despite recommendations to the contrary by the committee formed to consider the scheduling of drugs. At the time, marijuana use was strongly correlated in the minds of the populace with the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam movement, and other dissidents. It is clear that by restricting and criminalizing marijuana, the government sought to restrict and criminalize those who used it, those who sought peace and social justice. In 1986, the Controlled Substances Act was amended by the Anti-Drug Abuse Act. This act was the first legal recognition of the distinction between powdered cocaine and crack cocaine. The distinction created was not only one of definition, but of repercussion. The intent to distribute quantity of powder cocaine was 100 times that of the intent to distribute quantities of crack form of cocaine. This disparity is somewhat suspicious. When one considers the popular association of crack usage with the African American community and the usage of powder cocaine with that of white affluent individuals, the timing is likewise suspicious, as only 3 years prior, the first federal prison was privatized. The privatization of prisons has been a problematic venture at best. Because their motivations are rooted in profit, it does not behoove corrections corporations to receive only their contract payment from the government. Instead, for-profit prisons often make use of their prisoners as labor. One of the popular images of prison labor is that of the chain gang. However, prison labor in the modern day is typically one of manufacturing. Prisoners make products such as clothing, furniture, and textbooks. For this work, they may be reimbursed from 23 cents to $1.15 per hour. Some of this wage is withheld for room and board. It has been proposed that part of the reason for-profit prisons have flourished is because globalization has put stress upon the United States economy. As the third world countries offer low manufacturing rates, U.S.-based companies have had to find new ways of competing. It seems obvious that using prison labor to become economically competitive is morally reprehensible, and many countries agree. Even the United States agreed that using prison labor is immoral when it censored China for doing the same thing in the 1990s. One of the largest costs associated with any business is employee turnover. The costs associated with training new employees are such that corporations often work to ensure that employees stay with the company through incentives. Since such incentives are not available for prisoners, correctional corporations have to instead ensure that their workforce remains imprisoned. This is accomplished primarily by inflating infractions to lower the chance of parole. One example of this practice is referenced in a story on prison farm labor. A woman known by N discussed the horrific conditions of this particular form of labor. N stated that they were 8 hours straight. The prisoners are supposed to have 2 15-minute breaks, but even those are often denied. The prisoners will run out of water and are not given more, even if requested. When making health complaints, the prisoners are often laughed at by the guards. N experienced this herself firsthand when she began to have chest pains. She stated that she did not want to continue working, and the guards not only refused to help her, but also told her that if she did not get back to work, her record would reflect an infraction, thus reducing her chance of parole. This strategy of reducing parole opportunities ensures that the correctional corporation's labor forces remain intact. Even in the public prison sector, this free labor has been exploited by prison officials and governmental agencies. In 2014, after being ordered by the Supreme Court to parole some of their nonviolent prisoners, the state of California was attempting to prevent this from occurring. The California Attorney General's office stated that paroling prisoners would be detrimental to the state's ability to fight wildfires. The motion included explicit statements such as extending 2-for-1 credits to all minimum custody inmates at this time would severely impact fire camp participation. The Attorney General's office went to indicate that if these prisoners were not available for fire camp participation, then other services such as garbage or city park crews would be impacted, implying that the governmental agencies responsible for maintaining these services could not simply hire more employees, demonstrating that they are dependent on this labor force. Perhaps no policy works better to help the correctional corporations than the three strikes laws. These laws send people to prison for life if they have engaged in felony-level criminal behavior 3 times. It should be noted that the decision to charge an individual with a felony versus a misdemeanor crime is made by the prosecuting attorney. Felony convictions are sought at higher rates when the alleged perpetrator is a person of color, highest of all if they are black. Infractions for which 3-strike laws have been invoked include stealing pizza or spare change from a car. Of course, many prisoners who are incarcerated for life without the possibility of parole, or LWOP, are those who have been imprisoned for drug-related charges. For some, this can be distributing drugs. For others, it can be involvement in a drug-oriented criminal outfit. They may have been a lookout or go-between for buyer and seller. These LWOP prisoners are the most stable of the labor force for correctional corporations, as they will never be released, are not on death row, and are often incarcerated for nonviolent crimes. Ostensibly, the purpose of prison labor is to provide prisoners with the marketable skill upon release. However, LWOP prisoners will never have the possibility of being released. So marketable skills are in actuality meaningless. In addition, convicted felons are less likely to be able to acquire a job upon release due to the number of employers who will not hire felons. This is especially hard on African American men, as African American men with no criminal record are less likely to be hired for a position than a white man with a felony conviction. For African American men with a record, acquiring gainful employment becomes next to impossible. When these men cannot find legitimate employment, criminal enterprises are often the only viable solution for them to turn to in order to support themselves. They are often arrested again within a few months of being released. In addition, one must take into account the role addiction plays on this cycle. People released from prison after receiving a felony conviction often do not have access to treatment programs. As prisons are not often drug-free environments, imprisoned addicts gain access to the drugs to which they are addicted. Thus, they are released still addicted and seek out their substance of choice. Drug offenders are twice as likely to violate their probation or parole, returning them to prison. However, it has been proven that treatment of an addiction ensures that an addict is less likely to return to the tendencies which incriminated them originally. The length of time in these treatments is proportional to the rate at which they may recidivate. The longer programs tend to produce individuals less prone to imprisonment. It seems surreal that these practices are present in our society, and is only heightened with the justification of these practices written within the very amendment ratified to remove slavery as a viable form of labor. neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. The juxtaposition of abolishing slavery while simultaneously maintaining it for yet another subclass is both astonishing and unsettling. That prisoners have been intended for slave labor is evident from the words of the Virginia Supreme Court when in 1871 they stated that prisoners are slaves of the state. The case has been made that prison labor is a form of legal slavery. Does it then necessarily follow that this form of slavery targets African Americans specifically and people of color more generally? To answer this question, one can look at the history of laws designed to target black people, starting with the post-Civil War black codes, continuing on to the Jim Crow laws, and finally with the war on drugs. Each of these sets of laws have been designed to specifically aim legal repercussions towards African Americans, and because racists have blurry aim, other people of color. In 2014, there were more African American men in prison on parole or on probation than there were enslaved in 1850. This startling fact is only a part of the troubling story about the rate of African American men under the control of the criminal justice system. African American men make up 46% of the prison population. African Americans in general only make up 12% of the population. This obvious disproportionate incarceration is further highlighted when one considers other statistics. The rate of African American men who were imprisoned in the year 2000 was 3,457 per 100,000, whereas white men were incarcerated at a rate of 449 per 100,000. This equates to a ratio of 7.7 black men incarcerated to every one white man incarcerated. Considering that the ratio of African Americans and white Americans in the general population is almost inverse, 1-6, it is quite obvious that our criminal justice system is targeting the African American community. As mentioned earlier, the amount of crack cocaine needed for a felony conviction is a much smaller amount than the amount of powder cocaine needed. This is despite the fact that there is no difference in potency or neurological effect in the different forms of this drug. Because felony charges carry much longer sentences than misdemeanor charges, and because crack cocaine has been typically associated with African Americans and powdered cocaine with white Americans, there is, by default, a disparity between the sentencing of white and black Americans for possession of such substances. Even without this formal distinction in law, implicit racism has been found to be prevalent in the criminal justice system by numerous studies. These studies have found that juries and judges alike are more likely to impose harsher sentences against African Americans. In addition, African Americans are less likely to be offered plea bargains, which might reduce penalties they are likely to face. Juries are also more likely to impose the death penalty for African American defendants than white defendants. The most extreme disparity between African Americans who kill whites and whites who kill African Americans, the former being 11 times more likely to receive the death penalty than the latter. The penalties associated with the drug convictions are both numerous and harsh. They include a revocation or suspension of driver's license, an inability to get benefits from temporary assistance for needy families, and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Convicted drug felons cannot gain federal assistance for education in the form of student aid or the HOPE tax credit. They are not permitted to benefit from any federal health programs and can even sometimes be barred from public housing. This can lead to burdens on any family that the paroled or released felon may return to. These burdens are not limited to the felons who are no longer incarcerated. There are also burdens related to the absence of the individual. This can include the lack of income, which the absent individual may provide to his or her family, the lack of strong emotional ties between a child and their incarcerated parent, and the time commitment that can be shared between parents to raise a child, now shouldered by one parent, and other forms of more ephemeral support, the lack of which can be definitely felt in a single-parent family. There are also costs to the larger community. Children in these environments are less likely to thrive in an educational setting. There is a negative correlation between academic achievement and crime rates. That is, an environment in which a large portion of adults are imprisoned can lead to the same for the children of that community. Black children are 7.5 times more likely to have a parent in prison than white children. In addition, the lack of able-bodied adults can have other impacts. Roles within the community may go unfulfilled, there may be fewer people to care for aging adults, and projects which may benefit the community may never be completed. One of the more egregious examples of how drug prohibition affects African-American children is that of prison nurseries. The principle of prison nurseries is a sound one. Mothers who give birth in prison and who are allowed to keep their children are much less likely to reoffend. This seems like a laudable goal, yet the method leaves much to be desired. These children are imprisoned with no due process and at no fault of their own. Allowing a child to bond with its mother is important. However, the expense is that the child does not bond with its other relatives, for example, siblings, the father, grandparents, and so forth. In addition, the child is left in the care of other inmates when the mother is working, because having a child does not excuse one from prison labor. The child will then emotionally bond with these inmates, who will be separated from the child upon their release or their mother's release. This kind of separation can cause emotional trauma in the child, which can lead to attachment difficulties in future relationships. Attachment difficulties can eventually lead to psychopathology in the form of personality or mood disorders, which can lead to a drug abuse. This issue may seem overwhelming and unresolvable, but there are a number of steps the United States may take in order to change the radically motivated and damaging policies of drug prohibition. Such policy changes should include a change of drug prohibition from being considered a criminal problem to a public health problem. Rather than putting citizens in prison, we should instead be placing them in treatment facilities if needed. First, legalize, regulate, and tax all drugs in the same way that tobacco and alcohol are. All existing nonviolent drug convictions should be voided. Those prisoners whose convictions are voided should be released. They should enter public housing with a state-sponsored employment training program. For 3 years, appropriate monetary support should be given to those recently released, which will give time for the employment trainer program to impart skills or for them to start an academic program if they so choose. Former convicts should also receive assistance in obtaining employment, whether through a job placement program or through government-created jobs. If they are currently addicted to drugs, they should be offered treatment to help deal with the addiction in a healthy way. This safety net will become possible due to the lack of prisoners whose room and board have been paid for by the state and the tax income accumulated from the now legalized recreational substances. If these changes are implemented, one can hope that it will have a positive impact on race relations within the United States. The uphill battle for equality is far from complete. Implicit discrimination of African Americans permeates our society through the use of prohibition under the guise of a war on drugs. Perpetuating absentee parents when guidance is needed at critical stages of childhood development. This country's privatized prisons continue to profit from these practices in light of the destruction of mental, physical, familial, and community health. These atrocities against people continue and must not be hidden under a blanket of apathy.